This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 285.
This podcast is brought to you by thenewkneeshop.com. Don't let knee pain slow you down or sideline you altogether. Let the latest running innovation, New Knee, help you get back on track. It's designed specifically to relieve that dreaded runner's knee pain. And available today at newkneeshop.com. That's newkneeshop.com. And use the code MTA10 for a 10% discount. That's newkneeshop.com. Use the code MTA10.
This podcast is also brought to you by Varidesk. Varidesk is the world's leading standing desk solution, converting any desk into a standing desk so you can maintain a healthy, active lifestyle in the office or at home. And Varidesk comes with a 30-day risk-free guarantee and free shipping both ways. To learn more about Varidesk standing desk solutions, visit varidesk.com/workelevated. That's varidesk.com/workelevated.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about helping you reach your full potential as a long-distance runner. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we bring you a fascinating conversation with runner and filmmaker Sanjay Rewal about indigenous running cultures, running as meditation, and the world's longest certified foot race, the Self-Transcendence 3100-mile race in New York City. And in this episode's quick tip, Coach Angie answers a question about how much treadmill training you should do in your marathon buildup. And just a quick heads up, you can get all of our back episodes, training plans, and support from our awesome online community inside the Academy. Check out membership when you visit marathontrainingacademy.com. All right, Angie, this is an exciting episode. A little bit of chit-chat here in the beginning. We've got some races that we've signed up for this summer. Some new developments for us because our summer looks like it's finally taking shape as far as our travel plans and stuff. So we will be in northern Michigan at the Charlevoix Marathon, June 22nd. Angie's going to run it. I'll be staying with the kids. Sounds like it's a really beautiful marathon. Not the easiest place in the world to get to.
And it won't be the largest marathon ever. Probably be a big contrast from London, but I'm looking forward to it. I like small races.
And that'll be your official Michigan marathon in your 50-state quest.
That's right.
And then we've had a hard time, you know, finding a race in South Dakota that's worked with our schedule. There's not a whole lot of races out there. But 1 week after the Charlevoix Marathon, we will be at the Black Hills 100 in Sturgis, South Dakota. Angie will be running the 50K.
What could go wrong?
The photos look absolutely amazing, you know, of this race. Part of it's on the Centennial Trail. And if you are going to be at either one of these races, let us know. Send us an email through our contact form. You know, perhaps we can see you there.
So, Trevor, what races are you thinking about this summer?
Well, I've got a little half marathon I'm going to do on June 8th called the Iron Run down at Pine Creek Furnace State Park here in PA. And then later this summer, I'm going to run my first ultra. I'm going to do a 50K in Montana. It's called the Divide 50. It's in Butte, and part of it goes on the beautiful Continental Divide Trail. And there's free beer and stuff afterward. And just, yeah, sounds like an epic place for one's first ultra.
So good incentive to get to the finish line, right?
That's right. I'm sure it's really going to kick my butt. You know, it's further than I've ever run. I just feel like completely dead at the end of a marathon if it's hilly or hot. So, you know, who knows what I'm getting into here. I've been contemplating doing an ultra for a while, so glad to finally be taking action on this.
Yeah, it's something you can definitely handle.
That's what's going on with us. We are excited to be doing some more traveling. This summer, we're going to take the old camper out again. Probably a lot of you remember from last summer, we pulled our travel trailer all the way to Alaska, and Angie did the Juneau Marathon. Thankfully, we won't have to drive that far this time. We're just going to go out west to Montana and Washington State, where my parents are, and then come on back. But yeah, we'll probably spend about 2 months in the camper. So epic road trip. We quite don't have a nickname for it yet, though. I was thinking Angie and Trevor's Epic Mountain Ultra Chub Rub Adventure.
That's a mouthful. Something has to go in that string of words.
As long as we keep the Epic Mountain Ultra, we got to keep that in there because we're doing ultras, and Adventure and Chub Rub.
I think the chub rub can go because I'm not planning on rubbing my chub.
I plan on rubbing your chub, baby. Okay, moving along here. All right, so what else is going on out there in MTA land? We got some members doing incredible things, so let's give some shout-outs here. What do you got for us?
That's right. Adri wrote and said, I finished my first marathon in Ogden, Utah. Wow, it was beyond amazing. I was running for Run to Remember, which raises awareness about veteran suicide. More specifically, it was for one of my junior Marines, as this weekend was the anniversary of her passing and not making it home. The theme of the run is to get out and live. Well, needless to say, something beyond amazing happened, and I still don't have adequate words for what I experienced. Just before the start, and then again as I was crossing the finish, I dropped to my knees and had to cry happy tears for a minute. Thank you to all those in this group who reached out and to those who crossed the line today with me.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, congrats on running your first marathon, Adri. Sounds like it was a transformational experience, so keep up the great work.
That's right. And this comes from another member, Brooke. She says, I just wanted to offer a deeply heartfelt thanks to Angie Trevor and MTA Coach Lynn and every inspiring runner in the MTA family. I completed my first full marathon at the Cleveland Marathon, and although I've been a runner for over 20 years, I had never believed I could reach the heights of 26.2 miles until I started listening to the MTA podcast. Your stories, your challenges, and victories and passion finally gave me the courage to try. While my time was less than impressive, I never felt like anything but a champion. As someone who has a bad habit of negative self-talk, this is actually pretty astonishing. With what I've learned over the last year in the MTA community and podcast, I was able to gain a new perspective. Through 87-degree heat and hip pain, I practiced gratitude and thanksgiving, visualization, and mental fortitude. In a moment of losing my mind, I also referred to myself as Momgins, the mom version of David Goggins.
We've been trying to get David Goggins on the podcast. That guy is a beast.
Yes, he's amazing. She says, many people ran in pairs or teams, but I was totally alone. While this was difficult for me, I also found it healing and much needed for my spirit. It's amazing to me how something so exhausting can be so restorative. Something so empty can be so filling. Something that nearly breaks me can heal me. I don't know if I'll ever run a full marathon again, but I'm thankful to all of you for helping me dream and have such an epic experience.
Well, thank you for that report, Brooke, and it was awesome to help you train for first that Jerusalem half marathon and then your first full marathon there in Cleveland. The first marathon's always tough, but think about if you have to do an 87-degree heat. I can't imagine, you know?
That would wipe me out.
And on a sadder note, there was someone at that marathon who collapsed and didn't make it.
Yeah, that's right. 22-year-old Taylor Sipo, a recent college graduate, collapsed 1 mile from the half marathon finish line and wasn't able to be resuscitated. And a listener named David wrote in and he said, I participated in the 42nd running of the Cleveland Marathon this weekend doing the half. I witnessed efforts to resuscitate her on the course by paramedics and I knew it was bad, but I was devastated to later learn that she had died. Although I never knew her, I've been moved by her death more than I can explain. From all accounts, she was an excellent student athlete and an exceptional person off the field.
Well, well said, David. And our heart definitely does go out to the family of Taylor and just the whole running community, I'm sure, just grieves with them. It's always hard to hear something like this, you know, because every year there are a few people here in the States that do collapse at a marathon. And it's a number of factors, I think, that why that happens, but just always shocking to hear about, don't you think?
Yeah, it is very sad.
So definitely our thoughts and prayers to Taylor's family.
That's right. We'd also like to give a shout out to Peter. He says, I PR'd at the Ogden Marathon and I broke 4 hours by the skin of my teeth with a time of 3 hours, 59 minutes, and 27 seconds. Breaking 4 hours has been my goal and I've had the help of MTA Coach Dom for the last year. Going in, I was confident about my chances, but the day turned into a roller coaster ride. At several points in the race, I thought my 4-hour attempt was lost, but I was able to stay just within range. After gaining time from a couple of downhill miles, I realized at mile 20 that the goal was within my grasp if I maintained a 9-minute pace for the remaining way. At that point, I was already pretty well spent. The rest of the race became an excruciating experience. It was the mental battle we all go through to keep running, but it was so much more intense this time. Knowing I didn't have any cushion, I knew that stopping wasn't an option. The last mile was truly the longest mile. I haven't felt such jubilation and relief in a long time as I crossed the finish. Thanks to Coach Dom for her guidance and the MTA community for your inspiration.
Well, congrats on the PR, Peter, and what he had to say there. It really illustrates, you know, the battle within a person as they're getting through the marathon and especially getting through, you know, with a time goal in mind.
Exactly. You have to really dig deep to hit those big goals and those PR attempts. And I think, yeah, he definitely illustrated that very well. This note comes from Steven. He says, "Hi, MTA. I apparently have what it takes to run an ultra marathon. Last week, I ran a local 50K and finished in just under 7 hours. It was very hot, very blistery, and very fun."
I don't see how those words can go together. Hot, blistery, fun.
Only a long-distance runner can string that particular group of words together.
Yeah, exactly.
3 weeks before the 50K, I ran the Louisville Marathon, and 3 weeks before that, I ran another local marathon with a friend. I never thought I'd be able to run 3 marathons in less than 2 months, and I wanted to say thanks, Angie and Trevor, for all the inspiration, encouragement, and practical advice. We are capable of so much more than we think, and I'm very grateful to this community for helping me to realize that.
Maybe I do have what it takes to run a 50K after hearing that.
Oh, yeah.
We will see.
There's no doubt.
Come July. It'll be hot, hilly, and fun.
And maybe blistery.
Epic chub rub adventure.
And we'd also like to say congratulations to Heather. She says, "Today I finished my fourth 50K with the help of my amazing MTA coach, Jennifer. I felt strong and PR'd the course by 55 minutes.
Nice. Well, congrats to all of you out there taking action in your health and life and running to new heights. I know you'll enjoy this interview. Sanjay Rawal is a very well-spoken, very thoughtful interview subject. And we had such a great time talking to him. He worked in the human rights and international development sector for 15 years in over 40 countries before focusing on his love of photography and storytelling and becoming a filmmaker. He's a lifelong runner, meditator, and he is the creator of the film 3100 Run and Become, which opened in theaters in the fall of 2018. You know, for years, we have heard about this race in New York City, the most insane-sounding endurance race I've ever heard of. It's called the Self-Transcendence 3100 Miler, where runners just go around a block for 52 days until they rack up 3100 miles. So I think I first heard about that race in the book Born to Run. I can't remember. But I just knew that race was there. I knew that that's like a whole nother level of crazy, right? I mean, even people like Dean Karnazes don't even go and do that, right?
Yeah, so this is really a great look inside the race at the type of runners who take on this challenge and really a lot about the mental and spiritual side of running as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's the beauty of it is the whole idea of self-transcendence, of flow, finding the joy in running step after step, even if it's just monotonous, hot and whatever. So a lot of great mindset stuff in this. He also talks about the storied marathon monks of Japan, the Navajo runners, African Bushmen, and of course the history of the 3100 and the type of athletes who go and do this and what we can learn from them. So yeah, a lot of great stuff in this interview. I know you guys will love it. I'll go ahead and play our conversation with Sanjay Rawal right now.
Well on my way, well on my way.
All right, we're on the podcast now with Sanjay Rawal, who's joining us from New York City. Sanjay, great to have you on the podcast.
Oh, man, I am so excited. I've been a fan of the pod for a little while now. And yeah, it's great to get a chance to speak with both of you.
Well, we just recently saw your movie, 3100, Run and Become. And we had known about the 3100-mile transcendence run for a while. And we've actually talked about it on the podcast as like the ultimate example of, you know, extreme ultra marathon. But we've never really talked in depth about it or talked to anybody connected with it. So we're so excited to talk to you. Let's just start with what's your story and how did you get involved in the running world and doing what you do?
Well, you know, I was a pretty decent high school track athlete in California, you know, had some state ranked times and big state. So ran against some really fast people. But I'm from a first generation immigrant family, and neither my coaches nor my parents really understood how track and running could be a lifelong pursuit. And it just went by the wayside after my first couple of years in college. Running in those days had just been for competition and was so pressure filled that I didn't feel any joy from it, and I didn't know how to find joy. But as most of us who kind of burnout in Division One. I picked it back up in my 20s and literally learned to run for totally different reasons. Rather than crushing other people, which wasn't a possibility anymore, it was, you know, crushing my bad quality, so to speak.
I think people are really going to resonate with that because, you know, most of the people who listen to the show are running to become better versions of themselves. And yeah, we know we're never going to make it to the Olympics or even probably win marathons or races. But, you know, it's like you said, a whole different reason. And I think that's really what's so exciting about the movie that you've done, 3100 Run and Become. So you kind of started running again in your 20s. You also have a longstanding meditation practice. How did running and meditation fit together for you?
You know, running was like a toxic relationship for me. And even though I moved after college, I moved to New York City to study expressly with the Indian spiritual teacher Sri Chinmoy, who was at the forefront of the New York City running boom in the 70s and was really part of the early movement in the 80s to really amplify multi-day distance running. And I'll get to that in a second. I ran as a physical pursuit. I ran for health, but it wasn't until I started making this movie, 3100 Run and Become, that things finally made sense. And I saw and learned how running was a bedrock spiritual practice for human beings for millennia. It's only been in the last few hundred years that, you know, we've really been separated from the kind of organized spiritual pursuit of running.
So you were kind of talking about how the running boom in the 70s came about. And back then, it was really only the kind of the super serious runners who were taking part in these events like marathons. It wasn't something necessarily that the everyday person felt they could be a part of. And then, like you said, it kind of got to be where, I mean, now ultra marathons are pretty normal. You know, we're used to hearing about them. But back then, that wasn't part of the culture at all.
I mean, it's interesting because in the late 1800s, there was an event called the pedestrianism, where people would walk around a quarter mile loop in Madison Square Garden in Manhattan, and people would bet on who could cover the most miles in 6 days. Hmm. At the same time, the first president of the New York City Roadrunners Club and, you know, 1952 Helsinki Olympic marathoner Ted Corbett, by the time he got into like 1960, 1965, he was bored of the marathon, and he was regularly putting in 250, 300-mile training weeks through the streets of New York City. So fast forward to 1983. You know, marathoning was no longer counterculture, and a lot of folks were really interested in pushing the boundaries. At the same time, Fred LeBeau, then president of the Roadrunners, he and Sri Chinmoy, you know, were close and kind of hatched the idea of reviving the six-day race. And that was done in Flushing Meadow Park in 1983. And after Fred passed away of cancer in the early 90s, Sri Chinmoy and his marathon team took it over. By the late 80s, Sri Chinmoy's marathon team had seen that people were hungry for distances longer than what they could accomplish in 6 days. And so we started sponsoring 1,000-mile, 1,300-mile races. And that eventually grew to a 2,700-mile race in 1996. And then eventually the 3,100-mile race, which started in 1997 and has been taking place every summer since.
What's Sri Chinmoy's story? What's his background?
He was raised in a spiritual community in an ashram in South India. And interestingly enough, that ashram, the Sri Aurobindo ashram, was very dynamic. We tend to look at India and the East as pretty sedate, quietly contemplative societies. I think that's really due to the effect of colonization. But India's greatest epic, the Bhagavad Gita, was a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, and it took place literally on a battlefield. And so the idea of inner progress and outer progress in India had gone together for millennia. At the same time, the martial arts in China and Japan, you know, were foundationless without a spiritual practice. So in this ashram in South India, the teacher, Sri Aurobindo, revived this sense of dynamism, and they built a track. And as they got European students, you know, those European students began to teach other people the ins and outs of track and field. So short story long, he was a champion decathlete for the 20 years that he lived there. Hmm. And when he came to the U.S. in the 60s, the running boom hadn't started. But by the mid-70s in New York City, he really, really took advantage of making the opportunity to make the connection between running and the inner life.
And you knew him personally, it sounds like.
I was lucky. You know, I spent 13 years, you know, living two blocks from him in New York City, traveling with them and really looking at that segment of my life as like graduate school. But I was focusing on inner philosophy and inner education rather than science or liberal arts.
So once the distance expanded, you talked about the 1,000 mile, the 1,300. Has it always been in Jamaica Hills, Queens, New York? I mean, has it, the longer distances always been in that particular block?
Yeah. You know, so there was obviously like a kind of a very small trail running subculture. And as we know, Western states didn't even start out as a human race.
Right.
And so a lot of the really long 50-100 milers that people began really doing in earnest, you know, were on so-called like unsanctioned, uncertified courses. But when ultra distance running really started taking effect in the 60s and 70s, it was really because of Ted Corbett. And Ted wasn't just the pioneer there, but he was a pioneer in race standards. He was the one who found the five borough course for the New York City Marathon and really taught people how to measure courses properly. And so most of the early ultra runs were on loops. And when you're pushing to 24, 48, 72 hours, you know, you start forgetting about location and you don't care about like whether you're running through forests or by oceans. You want consistency. You want aid. You want restrooms. You want food and medical regularly. And so all those early multi-day races were all done around 1 mile loops in New York City. And so when Sri Chinmoy pushed to 1,000 miles, then 2,700 miles, the only conceivable way of doing that was around what eventually became a half-mile looped course around a high school on sidewalk held in the summer heat of New York City.
Is there a reason why it's held in the summer?
It's permits. You know, we've done races in parks, and it's really hard for us even to get a permit to do a 10-day race, which we do every April in Flushing Meadow Park, where the U.S. Open is held. But the idea of being able to find a course where you can get a steady stream of volunteers, you know, necessitated not doing it in a forest or not doing it in a remote area. So we do it close to where our marathon team is based. And we couldn't get a permit in a park, but the city allowed us to use the perimeter of a school as long as school was out of session. And so the race is driven by logistics. At the same time, like, I wilt in the summer heat in New York City. But when I've gone out on the most epically humid days where the heat index, like Pennsylvania, can be up to 108, 110 degrees, the runners become oddly acclimatized. The first week apparently is torture, no matter what year, whether it's cold or hot. You're getting used to digestion, the hard surface, the weather. But they pretty quickly develop an efficiency that's mind-boggling.
I want to get back to that. So tell us about this race. What are the rules and what's the logic of the race, essentially?
So the race course is about 0.55 miles. And people have to average a little over or a little less than 59 miles a day in order to finish within the 52-day window. Unlike most multi-days where the courses are open 24 hours, the race directors realized, based on the first crop of runners in 1996, 1997, who would have run 24 hours a day if they had the chance and probably would have like ground themselves into a pulp, the courses only open 18 hours a day. And the one rule is that you have to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning for the start. You can take as many breaks as you want to, but if you start averaging less than 50 miles a day, the race directors have the discretion to pull you out of the race. So this is not something to like lollygag around. It's like they want people who are committed to attempting to reach that 3,100 mile goal. The only variation in the course is that every day the course switches directions. That's it. And there's about a 9-foot height variation on each loop. So I think they end up doing double Everest over the course of 52 days. But that's it. It's like, you know, there's RVs on the course. There are cooks that provide pretty specialized meals, 10 to 12,000 calories a day. Runners sometimes have handlers, sometimes don't. They're all given accommodation within a mile or 2 mile, radius from the course, and they're left to their own devices.
And there's a lap counter as they come around, and the laps are put up on a board, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing is that the runners are counting in laps. The board is in miles. And so runners have to do about 109 laps to reach that 59-mile daily average. And so they're pacing themselves by lap. But then again, the oddity of doing this particular race is it's very much, you know, its own specialized event. By 11, 12 o'clock noon, the heat index rises pretty dramatically. And so people are really, you know, they're warming up between 6 and 8 in the morning. It's like a slow jog, a quick walk. From 8 to noon, they're trying to do about, 20, 25 miles. And then pretty much everybody just tries to survive between 12 and 6 p.m. And then usually from 6 to 12, people are cranking. So across the day, 60 miles in 18 hours, it's less than 4 miles an hour. But at the same time, you know, people don't run the curves. They don't run the little uphills. When they're jogging, they're probably between 10 and 12 minute pace, but they do spend a substantial amount walking at 14, 15 minute mile pace.
And how many people finish on average per year?
So this year, there are 8 participants. On average, there's between 10 and 14. We found that probably 55-60% of the people finish. But if you break it down in terms of gender, probably 40% of the men finish, 75% of the women finish.
So we know a lot of ultra runners, but you know, don't know anyone who's ever done the 3,100-mile race. Talk about the type of person that is attracted to this kind of event.
You know, it's interesting because the people that began, you know, as the trailblazers, they were all pretty much sub-230 marathoners. The first person who really established an incredible mark for the course record was a man named Wolfgang Schwerk, who has the second fastest 24-hour time in history, slower than Yannis Kouros, who did, I think, 188 miles, faster than Scott Jurek, who did, I think, 172, 173 miles. And so folks that began running this race in the early 90s and early 2000s, they had pedigrees. They weren't necessarily trail racers, but, you know, they would do close to 250 miles in 48-hour races, et cetera. But then by the mid-2000s, I think that class of, like, super caliber ultra-distance runners began being lured by the trails. And you know, obviously that coincided with the huge boom in trail running. And so people that have tended to run this race have come from Europe, where that tradition of 24-hour track racing, 48-hour track or closed-loop racing is a lot more popular than it is in the U.S. And so we tend to get, I mean, this year there isn't a single American that signed up.
Nor was there in the movie, right?
No, and like there's been an American woman, Superba Beckhard from Washington, D.C., who still holds most of the female records in the U.S. from like 1,000 miles on up. She did the race 13 summers in a row.
Wow.
There was a gentleman named Arpan D'Angelo, who was a 1,000-mile specialist in the 80s, who did the race twice, completed it once. And then 2 years ago, a 60-year-old African-American woman, a race walker from Los Angeles, Yolanda Holder, finished the race with about an hour to spare. There's only been, you know, 5 or 6 Americans that have completed the distance.
Well, traditionally now, as you know, the race distances get longer, you see kind of the differences between men's and women's performances shrink. You know, kind of just the endurance abilities of women kind of really start to shine in those longer distances. Have you noticed that with this particular race?
I have. And frankly, I think the reason why women, this is just my own biased opinion, the reason why women haven't surpassed men in this particular race is a mental thing. Like to me, it's not a big deal that Courtney Dow Walter is like beating men across the board. It's almost like she knows she can do it and she knows not to listen to anybody else. And so she does it. I've seen a number of 6 and 10 day races that have been won by the woman. And unlike the like top marathons, for example, where the top woman isn't even in the top 20 or 30 men, you know, in these 6 and 10 day races, the top woman is generally in the top 3 men. Hmm. And so I almost look at it as a mental barrier. Like there literally is no reason why women shouldn't be winning these races hands down. And in the 3,100, you know, the top woman is generally in the top three every year. In one race, like the top woman was in the top two. And it's just a matter of time. And I don't think it has anything to do with the caliber of the men. It's not like a woman is gonna win in an off year. I think it's just a matter of time before the women just say, like, forget it. I'm going to punch it from the beginning, and I'm not going to measure myself according to the men in the race, and I'm not going to be scared of being better than them.
And you said that 75% of the finishers have been women, right?
Well, it was 75% of the women who toe the line finish.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, like, more, like, as a percentage, like, they're far, like, women are far more successful in this race. As I think we've seen, even in the marathon, it's like, you can't win a marathon with any particular mile split, but you can certainly lose a marathon by just blowing, you know, mile 17 or mile 2 or mile 7. And so this race is the same way, that it's like you can't win the 3100 in one day, but you can certainly lose it. And men have blown up by, like, not caring about their blister, not caring about little things, and not necessarily wanting to do worse on one particular day than they did the day before.
And if they're going to finish 3,100 miles in 52 days, they probably can't take any 0 days.
No 0 days at all. In fact, in the year that Yolanda Holder, then 60 years old, finished, she had one day where she did 36 or 40 miles instead of 60.
And it was a rest day.
Yeah. But that made her have to do 61 miles a day for the last 21 days. Mm. And increasing your pace by a mile or two for 20 straight days is effectively like trying to negative split a marathon by 15 or 20 seconds per mile.
Especially, I'm sure, since people are running on very little sleep. I mean, there's that window of time when the course is shut down. But I'm sure by the time, you know, they eat and kind of do the self-care things, the recovery things they need to, and actually lay down, you know, it may be very hard to get the amount of rest and for recovery, you know, just to be able to do this day after day.
I mean, the interesting thing I've seen in my own brief experience with multi-days is that you're at, and this ties into the movie quite strongly, like these multi-day races, unless you're cranking out 300 miles in 2 days, you're at this weirdly low aerobic threshold. Like you're basically like in zone one of your aerobic capacity the whole time. And, you know, we have a lot of anecdotal experience with fasting, how after a couple of days of fasting, you're no longer hungry. Your body begins, like, you know, using ketosis and generating energy in a way that's not traditionally based on intake. I've seen with the 3100 that much of the recovery happens by changing pace. You know, when I've done 6 day races and like laid down at night, it feels like you're basically laying in a bed with broken glass. You don't recover. Like your recovery and anti-inflammation practice happens when you're moving and there's circulation. And I see that with a 3100. Most runners will basically get 4.5-5 hours of sleep a night, but they tend to recover by getting back out on the course.
So kind of that active recovery. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've done some races where, like you said, like anywhere you lay, you're just in pain. So it almost feels better to get up and move around a little bit.
When we spent time in the Kalahari Desert with the Bushmen, you know, we went on a persistence hunt where, you know, we tracked game with them and chased that gigantic animal away from water for a really, really, really long period. And we move slowly, like you chase an animal, it would go off at 40 miles an hour, and then we would track it for 6 or 7 hours until we got close again, and then chase it some more. And it's in an exceptionally low aerobic zone, but the Bushmen could do that for days, for days and days and days and days. And you see that style of physical activity is hardwired into who we are as human beings.
Because our society wasn't agriculturally based until, you know, a few thousand years ago, perhaps. And that persistence hunting was part of the DNA, really, of our ancestors.
And we all have that capacity. Like, no one would be able to say, would be able to convince you if you've never done, like, a 5-day or 6-day fast that you could subsist off of your own, like, energy stores for that long. But when you do it, you go like, oh, yeah, this makes sense. And when we were with the Bushmen, it was really easy to see how that practice was something that actually wasn't even difficult to maintain.
Yeah, the movie highlights, you know, the incredible endurance of several cultures and several groups around the world. And kind of what was the idea with bringing all this together in the movie?
I had watched at 3100 passively and as a sometimes volunteer for 20 years. And I realized that nobody was doing this race based on mental willpower alone. Like, you had to be able to go into the same place that we focus on during practices of contemplation or faith. It's like, if you pray, if you meditate, if you do anything contemplative, Tai Chi, yoga, you enter into not a mindset, but like a different part of your being where that flow and that energy exists. And I saw that the runners were approaching the 3100 with that framework in mind. Like, they were doing it because they knew they'd become better people during that race. And the race kind of like famously says, like, this is the only race in the world that's guaranteed that, you know, you will be a different person than when you started.
Self-transcendence. Yeah,
exactly. It's that people do it for transformation, and you can't discover that ability for self-transcendence during the race. Like, that's part of your buildup. That's part of the practice. Like, you toe the line, you know, understanding that you've got different faculties and those faculties are ones that are going to be vital for this race. At the same time, in making a movie, that type of experience isn't visual. It's very deep, and it's on a kind of a level that they can't be described. But we wanted to show how normal those energies were. And so we went to Japan, spent time with the marathon monks, to the Kalahari Desert with the Bushmen, and to the southwest of the United States with the Navajo. And in each of those three examples, we got to film a side of the culture that those particular groups had never exposed to cameras before. So I think what we got to share was pretty special and unique.
Yeah, definitely. And from what I've heard, some of those groups like the Marathon Monks, they're really reluctant to be filmed.
You know, no one's filmed them since the 80s. At the same time, as you guys know from watching the film, the crux of the Marathon Monk practice is that once every 12 years, they pick one aspirant. It's open to men and women, but in 500 years, they haven't had a woman that's desired to do that particular event. Everybody has to do other feats that are maybe equally impressive, but that just aren't as visual. And so they pick somebody to do 1,000 days spread out over 7 or 8 years. And if listeners can put their math hats on, those 1,000 days are split into 10 100-day chunks, which means across 8 years or 7 years, in some years you're doing 2 times 100. But each 100-day cycle has a set mileage. The first couple of cycles are 13, 14 miles each, but the last cycle is 56 miles each. And these are on single-track trails. Usually the 11 miles, 13 miles requires a 1,000-meter elevation change. But if the aspirant doesn't finish his or her daily mileage on any one particular day, the caveat is they have to take their life.
Wow. So they run with a small sword tucked into their belt or what?
They were given a choice for 500 years of hanging themselves or running with a sword. But in the last 50 years, the Japanese government has made exposed blades illegal. So wow. Now they only have one choice. No one's taken their life in about 150 years.
But so they're literally running by the graves of other aspirants who took their life because they didn't complete the challenge.
And that's the interesting thing, because I would be shaking in my boots like every single day, every single minute. But their mental preparation is to be able to run in bliss. And in their mind, like, nobody takes on the challenge with the idea that they're going to quit. So they're full of positivity. They know that they're only going to be able to accomplish the distance and the quest by really channeling their inner powers of meditation and finding happiness at every moment. That happiness gives you strength. It allows you to go beyond the miles and allows you to ultimately reach your goal. And that's reflected really in the 3,100-mile runners. It's the exact same attitude.
Yeah, I'm sure definitely, you know, how many of us would sign up for an event knowing that if we didn't complete it, you know, we would have to take our own life. I mean, that your intentions would have to be super clear, super focused. And yeah, you would have to really totally have dedicated your life to that goal.
The good thing is that, you know, I think besides the marathon monk practice, there are no requirements in any race to like hang yourself. But at the same time, that's the interesting thing about the 3100, where you have to know when to quit. You know, it's like you have to know, like, when there's always another year to do the race. And there have been plenty of people who haven't been able to finish the distance their first year, but the experience was transformative anyhow. And they've realized, like, it's not about the distance. It's about the experience. And they come back year after year. Like, our main character, Ashprihan Alto, is coming back for the 15th time this summer.
I'm glad you brought him up, because I was wanting to ask about him. And maybe you can tell our audience his story. And he's from Finland. Is his real name Ashprihani, or is that a given, like, spiritual name?
It was a spiritual name. His birth name was Pekka.
Okay.
Kind of a common Finnish name. So he didn't run as a teenager. He cross-country skied. At the age of 20, he did both the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail in the same year. And wow. The next year signed up for a 700-mile race that this Reach Hawaii Marathon team was doing near the Bronx in New York City. And I believe he won. He's an interesting fellow because he's not a fast marathoner. I think maybe he's done 2:56 or so. He doesn't have good foot speed in a 2-mile or 5K race. His 24-hour best is around 130 miles. Like, that wouldn't be in the top, like, 200 men. But his 6-day mark is about 530 miles, which is a Finnish national record and would put him in the top 20 men all time. His 10-day mark is 833 miles, which is 83 miles a day for 10 days. And that's, like, top 5 or 10 all time. And this is how I measure him. So Wolfgang Schwork had the course record at the 3100. He averaged, I think, 75 miles a day for 41, 42 days. Ashprihan in 2015 ended up averaging nearly 77 miles a day. And Wolfgang is number 2 all time in the 24-hour race behind Yanis Kouros, who has every record from 24 to 1,000 miles. It's pretty much crazy. And Ashprihan is effectively sandwiched between those two in terms of capacity. So Ashprihan's fault is that he's not a specialist in a distance that has prize money, and not at a distance where you have sponsors. Mm-hmm. But he's one of the top multi-day runners, you know, that anybody historically has known about.
Does he hold the course record for the 3100?
Yeah, he did the 3100 mile distance in 40 days and 9 hours, which is effectively 76.776 miles per day. So upwards of 3 marathons a day, every single day for 40 days.
I'm just thinking of, like, you know, coming from Finland, like, into New York City, you know, in summer.
This oven.
Like, you know, what a shock to the system. Does he take, like, all of his vacation time and just, you know, come over here and run and sweat and...
Pretty much. And, you know, the interesting thing is, like, he's got a secret, and his secret training is to do as many different types of activities each day. Because in multi-day running, the one thing that kills you is your mind. Like, if you get a tiny little, like, ache and your mind focuses on it, that ache becomes a problem that stops you dead in your tracks. But if you learn how to minimize problems and to deal with them patiently and expeditiously, you can actually reduce those problems. And so in his training, he runs, he rock climbs, he works out. He just tries to bounce from as many activities to the other each day so that he can constantly change his mental outlook and his mental focus and his, like, mental approach to physical movement.
From the movie, I mean, he looks like a pretty unassuming guy. He looks fit, but you wouldn't think that here's this, like, ultra distance god, you know, if you would.
You know, he looks like a mailman because he is a mailman. He loves it. He does it for training. Like, for the last 20 years, from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m., 6 days a week or 5 days a week, he delivers papers and mail. And that's good for one reason. It's like he's basically erased lethargy from his life. Like, when you do a night shift and that's the only shift that you do, you know, you learn to, like, rely on sleep much less than the normal human being. And he's putting in 6 to 10 hours a day on his feet. And that's the trick for these multi-day runs. It's like when you train, it's not so much mileage per week. It's like, can you run 40 miles and then do a double shift at a restaurant? And can you do the same thing the next day? And that's how you build up like deep, deep stamina. I mean, that's what you need for the Pacific Crest Trail. That's what you need for like the Appalachian Trail. You need like that ability to move fast when you're going slow.
All right, let's talk about his spiritual and mental strength. Like, what makes him different?
The foundation, from what I've seen, for all of his running achievements is meditation. Hmm. You know, he's trying to get to a place where his mind doesn't place limitations on what he's doing. You know, if somebody told you, somebody told me, like, you know, you're going to have to go out this summer and run 60 miles a day on a sidewalk in the heat and like eat all your food out of cups and drink 4 gallons of water a day. And like, you know, you're going to chafe like crazy. You're going to get sunburned. You know, I would become obsessed with the problems.
Yeah.
And his great skill is minimizing the doubt in his mind. And it's minimizing the reality of problems. Like if you have a blister, it's not going to kill you. You're not going to die. You know, you're going to treat it and it's going to cause you pain. But if you find a way to minimize that pain and effectively turn that pain into joy, then it's just another experience and it's part of the race. Hmm. And so he's exceptional at negating the kind of like, not negating the existence of problems, but negating the idea that they're problems in and of itself. Like he takes everything just as an experience and as part of the race. And that allows him to really enter into what I guess scientists call a flow state. Hmm. And he can be in that flow state 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day where he's not thinking about the mileage. He's just thinking about being happy in the moment. And because of his natural ability, that tends to carry him to 72, 75 miles a day, every single day.
What do you see in his eyes as he's coming around and around and around and you're just watching him and the other runners that do this?
You know, people there, they become their best selves. And I'm saying this knowing how ratty some of these people can be outside the race. Like, as I'm saying this as their friend. Like when people are running in that race, like angst, irritation, division, those types of things are erased. Hmm. Like if you're really angry, if you're really, you know, channeling trauma or rage, it's going to consume you in that race. Like everything is amplified on the negative side and the positive side. And so people use happiness and joy as energy. And so it's almost this like beautifully childlike existence where the goal of this race, the only way you're going to like accomplish this race is if you can be in your most joyful state. And so they're so nice when they're doing the race. And they're so kind. They're so gentle. They're so open. And they're so eager. It's like every single lap is like they have to have fun. Mm. And people do this race because they have an exceptional ability to just have fun, even in what most of us would look at as an activity that wouldn't be fun at all.
So a real ability to be in the moment, but not blow things out of proportion, you know, like you said, that blister or whatever. It's kind of like in meditation, when you have a thought come into your mind, you just think that's a thought, you know, you don't have to place undue significance on it. And I suppose the same thing with physical feelings too. It's just, you know, feeling, deal with it and keep going.
Exactly. Like one of the things that I kind of like take from, you know, the experience of doing the race or filming the race, I should say, is that in my day-to-day runs, am I really grateful for the ability to be able to run? Or am I super obsessed? And I am to some degree with like my watch and like the GPS stuff and posting on Strava and all this stuff. But in the 3,100 mile race, they exist in that space of gratitude. You know, it's like the only way to effectively accomplish that distance is to surrender any sort of expectation. You go like, I am in it. I'm trained. I'm going to go out there and enter into a flow and let that flow guide me. And I'm going to have faith that that flow is going to take me to the end goal. And in essence, it's like that's the way it works. Like people come from different backgrounds, atheists, deeply like committed to traditions, but everybody has a practice of believing in themselves on a very, very deep level and trusting in that belief, not just as like a mindless form of like willpower. It's like they get energy from their experience of self-knowledge, if that makes any sense.
It does. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the conversation thus far. I'd like to take a quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, Nuuni. They've been a great partner of ours. And if you're suffering with runner's knee pain, which is usually concentrated around the kneecap, definitely check out this amazing device that helps relieve the pressure. It's called the Nuuni. It's made by a 2-time Ironman, Mike Immerling.
That's right. Mike was able to turn his engineering expertise and do this unique design, which relieves the pressure that each stride places on your kneecap. And research reveals if you relieve the pressure, you'll relieve the pain. So today it's Mike's mission to help runners enjoy running without knee pain. Runners like Joe, who's a retired Army officer, and he really struggled with runner's knee when he was deployed. He was no longer able to run, but Joe's mission was to return home and enjoy running again with his wife. Well, he got the Nuuni device, and Joe sent Mike a picture of a 5-mile run he enjoyed while pushing his baby girls in a stroller. And it doesn't get any better than returning a runner to what they love doing the best.
Yeah, that's right. So check it out. It's designed to provide immediate relief for runner's knee symptoms. Go to nuuneeshop.com. That's N-U-N-E-E shop.com. Use the code MTA10 for a 10% discount. That's nuuneeshop.com. Use the code MTA10. You mentioned earlier also including the Navajo and some incredible runners out there. Some footage that was shot in the movie, it looks like in New Mexico, right?
Yeah, eastern Arizona, on the border of New Mexico.
Okay, so maybe take a minute and talk about how the Navajo and their running culture kind of ties into the movie as well.
So I love this topic because, you know, most people I'm sure have, you know, read Born to Run and know about the Tarahumara.
Yeah.
One of the things that's hard to get from that book is the idea of running as prayer. It's obviously, it's in there, but one of the reasons why traditionally, with some exceptions like Billy Mills, Native Americans haven't like excelled on the world stage, and the Tarahumara haven't like crushed competition at Leadville, for example, year in and year out, is because running is prayer. And what I say to each of you guys, I pray better than you guys. You know, I'm way better at prayer than you guys.
Yeah, no one's going to say that.
No. So the idea of like showing off as a faster runner, it's not a concept. It's like you're running to get an inner experience. And if you happen to cross the finish line first, like whoop-de-doo. That said, you know, there are exceptional running traditions in the Southwest, where competition is honed and prized. But traditionally, and I'm not saying this is the case with everybody, but it traditionally before contact, before Europeans came over, running culture began at the earliest ages. And the first lessons of running were that running was a prayer. And so Native American boys and girls were indoctrinated into prayer as runners. And so the main difference I saw was like our main character, Sean Martin, an exceptional Navajo runner. Like when I went on morning runs with him, I realized that as soon as he stepped out his door, he was looking at that run as a way to become his best self right away. Like for those who've got to practice a meditation, you know, not every day is going to be great, but it's like you're doing it to have a better day. And that's the only reason why you're doing it. You're not doing it to like say like I'm going to do it for 700 hours or like you're doing it for a very clear reason. And that's not the reason why most of us step out the door running. It might be what we want to do, but like I didn't even know that was a possibility. But when I saw that Sean was all about the experience and all about connecting with his heart and connecting and feeling his run rather than thinking about his run, I realized like that I wasn't getting what I thought I was getting out of running. And that's the beautiful thing about indigenous North American running traditions. Like that practice still exists. It's kind of died out in, as you mentioned, Andy, like in societies that have really had agrarian lifestyles and really like non-nomadic, disconnected lifestyles from nature.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us, you know, can definitely take a lesson from that, because we tend to be so busy and distracted in our daily lives by, you know, whatever it is. We have 100 different devices and things calling our attention. And sometimes that run can just seem like another thing that we've got to do, we've got to check off, got to go hit those paces and everything. And of course, there's a place for that, but also using as a time to contemplate and just really connect to nature. And whether you pray or you just kind of let your soul and spirit breathe, you know, it just can be so much more.
And as you guys know from the film, one thing that Sean says is that when the Navajo run, they look at running as a teacher, they look at running as a celebration of life, but they look at running as a prayer. You know, when you run, your feet are praying to Mother Earth, you're breathing in Father Sky. Sean's dad, whom as you know is in the movie, who's a medicine man for the Navajo and an elder, he told me, he said, Mother Earth exists under the asphalt too. And so I've realized that, like, wow, it's so easy to connect with Mother Earth when you're running someplace glorious. Mm-hmm. But it's like, in a sense, it's superficial if you can't find Mother Earth in a place where she's not visible to your eyes. And that's what I get out of those Southwestern running cultures. And that has really transformed the way I look at running in New York City.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the 3,100 mile transcendence race is, you know, pretty much Mother Earth is totally buried, you know, but you're still able to find that that inner peace and gratitude even in the midst of that.
Yeah, when I first heard about the race, my thought was, why New York City around, you know, it's this block over and over? Why not just like out somewhere in the mountains where you can really be, you know, serene? But yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It's interesting too, because one of the kind of tips that Sri Chinmoy gave to the runners out there as a bit of like advice from like the founder was to actually become more conscious of the little bits of nature there and to really connect with that consciousness and to find the significance in that consciousness, and that could give you energy.
I like that. There's a little bit of nature everywhere, you know, and New York City's full of it, really. I mean, people take time to look. I like that.
And, you know, the race starts this year, June 16th. So, Trevor, Angie, if you guys feel like making the trip, you know, the actual race course is so oddly peaceful. You know, it's like if you go into a temple, no matter how nondescript, if there are people super committed inside, like you feel the vibe. And so even though every day outside the 3,100, the block is incredibly nondescript, even kind of like foreboding, when the run is happening, it's like you're forced to notice like all the beauty that surrounds you because the runners are focusing on it. And it's like, I say it's like NASCAR, where if you come for like one lap, it's going to be boring. But if you come with a lawn chair and you grab some sandwiches and you sit there for an hour or two, it's exceptionally watchable.
In the movie, there's a nice little shot as someone's going around. They touch the top of a fire hydrant, kind of turn it.
Yeah.
And it looks like that is maybe is what everyone does as they go around, or?
You know, so the race has been going on since 1997. If an average of 10 people do the race each year, and let's say a bunch finish, but the rest do like 2,900 miles, you're looking at 30,000 miles each year times 20 years. So there have been 600,000 miles raced on that course. That's a lot. You know, that's like 30,000 people doing the New York City Marathon. That's 600,000 miles. At the same time, like, people are looking for that consciousness. People are looking for the places in that course that are exceptionally meaningful. And some of it's there naturally and some of it's ascribed. So, you know, there's a few, like you mentioned, there's a few markers on the course, like the top of a fire hydrant, which spins and people kind of pretend like it's like a Tibetan mandala prayer wheel. Yeah.
That's what I thought when I saw that shot. A great shot.
There's a few other things like that, like where there's like a gate with a piston that lifts and drops and people kind of like mark, you know, their passage by that, by like lifting the piston and dropping it, and it thunks like very unceremoniously. But it's like acknowledging that the course itself is alive and that they're privileged to be on that course. And you know, if they run in alignment with that course. The alignment means a few things. Like the course has four corners and it's got a couple ups and downs. And so generally when world-class runners come to do the race, the first couple of days, they just run everything. But then they start noticing that the more experienced people are like walking all the slight uphills. They're walking around every corner. And it's like their style becomes dictated by the course rather than by their own conception of what running is like.
Do very many people come out and watch?
No. No. You know, they're like everybody in the neighborhood knows that it exists. And when people finish, you know, there'll be 100 or 200 people from the neighborhood and the community and volunteers that come out for the finish. But it's in, and I say this as pretty much a first-generation immigrant myself, came at 7 months old, but it's like in a pretty much minority first-generation immigrant area from cultures like mine that don't run and much less appreciate the nuance of the most extreme kind of hard-to-fathom race in the world. And people are moving at such an ordinary pace.
Yeah.
Like you'd go like, how could these people be world class? Like they're not even breaking like 12-minute mile pace. They're just like shuffling. So they don't look like the world class athletes that they are. So it's really easy to like miss the fact that there's anything spectacular going on.
Yeah.
But like I said, like when you come and you sit for like an hour or two, that's when you go, oh, I get it. Mm. I mean, this is what's going on. Like this is just unbelievable.
Well, it's a brilliant movie. We highly recommend all you guys that are listening, go and check out 3100 Run and Become. Sanjay, it's been a privilege talking to you. Where can we send people that want to learn more and find the movie?
The movie's on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, kind of anywhere where somebody goes and downloads movies. People can find us on Instagram at 3100film, or if they want to find out daily race updates for the 3100, it's at SCMTNY, Sri Chinmoy Marathon Team New York. So SCMTNY. And we'll be posting daily updates and there'll be geotags. And, you know, you can send me a message on that if you're going to come out. And we'll be absolutely thrilled to have you out there.
And it starts, you said, June 16th.
June 16th, Father's Day, until August 6th this year. And I don't know how it is down in Pennsylvania, but we've had some hot days already.
Humid.
So, humid. So if you get joy out of seeing other people suffer, this is the race to come and see. It's like it's a physical suffer fest, but it's amazing at how happy people are as they do it.
Well, you know, we have a lot of listeners in New York City, and maybe people have heard of this race, but they don't know anybody that does it, don't know anybody connected to it, so they haven't gone down to check it out. Are the runners... are they cool with just folks coming down to cheer them?
Oh, yeah, they love it.
Okay.
As per like IAU and USATF rules, like nobody can actually like run laps with the runners. But, you know, there's straightaways that you could jog with them and walk with them. And, you know, they'll get to know you. You'll get to know them. And if you bring like ice cream bars for everybody, there's only eight runners this year. There's seven men and one woman. If you stop at the deli and bring ice cream bars, it's like a stray dog. You will be their friend for life.
Manna from heaven.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Well, keep up the great work, and thanks for sharing your passion and your knowledge with us here on the MTA podcast, and best of luck to all the runners this year.
Well, thank you guys very much. I just love your show, and it's great to connect with you guys live and in the flesh. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Sanjay. Definitely go check out the movie 3100 if you haven't seen it yet. It'll make you feel like going out on a run, and that's what a running movie ought to do, right?
That's right.
I mean, even if you have no interest in ever doing an ultra or running 52 days.
Or any multi-day races.
Yeah. Just to know that people do that, you know, and to see the extent of human potential, and that includes all humans, right? I mean, we are capable of so much more than we give ourselves credit for, and I think that's what this movie really illustrates, among many other things. Well, in just a minute, we're going to get into this episode's quick tip, which is all about how much treadmill running should you do during marathon training if the weather or your allergies has forced you inside on the treadmill. Before we get into that, I'd like to say a quick word of thanks to this episode's sponsor, MetPro. MetPro stands for Metabolic Profiling. They analyze your metabolism and provide you with an individualized strategy to reach your weight loss and fitness goals. Probably a lot of you have heard that Angie and I have been working with a MetPro nutrition coach for the last 6 months or so, and we have really benefited from it. Angie even more, because being a type A person, she actually follows the program better than I do.
Yeah, I've just been beyond happy with MetPro and working with our nutritionist, Natalie. It's a concierge nutrition service, so it's very in-depth, very personalized, and it's just been phenomenal because I was extremely stuck with my weight for a long time, despite exercise and trying things on my own. So it's been wonderful to shed 24 pounds now and be feeling great and feel like I'm running strong again.
So to learn more, go to metpro.co, that's a .co, not a .com, /MTA, metpro.co/MTA. And we'd also like to thank Tiger Balm Active for sponsoring this episode. Tiger Balm Active is a non-greasy warming cream that is specifically designed for pre-workout, and it helps to get sore muscles ready to go for peak performance.
They also have the Tiger Balm Active Muscle Gel, which you can use after a workout. It's a non-sticky gel with a cool to warm sensation that helps with muscle fatigue and recovery. And for those hard to reach places, they also have the Tiger Balm Active Muscle Spray, which is super easy to apply. You can reach, you know, back behind those hamstrings, whatever you need to reach, and you can keep it in your car, gym bag, wherever it's handy, so you don't have to let discomfort slow you down.
This stuff doesn't mess around. I mean, you put it on, boom, you know instantly you have it on because
that's
it
right.
Is warming and cooling and working on that spot.
I particularly like to use it when I'm doing a lower body strength training workout because that can leave me super sore and crippling around. So I use the Tiger Balm Active Muscle Gel beforehand and then the Tiger Balm Active Muscle Rub afterward. And it's awesome to be so much less sore and be able to sit down with ease.
So don't let muscle aches and pain slow you down. You can pick up Tiger Balm Active today at your local CVS or Rite Aid store. Well, now it's time for this episode's quick tip. We want to answer a listener question about how much treadmill running should a person do during marathon training.
Yeah, this question comes from Craig. He says, I have a newbie training question. Since I live in a suburb of Houston, meaning it's hot for many months, and I suffer from allergies, a significant amount of my training will likely be on the treadmill. What percentage of my weekly mileage should be done outside, or does it matter? Is it better to do long runs outside?
I'm sure your heart goes out, Angie, as a fellow allergy sufferer, right?
Yes, I also have seasonal allergies, and a majority of my runs are on the treadmill in the months of April and May, just because of the high pollen count and trying to save myself some suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Another time when I had to utilize the treadmill a lot was when I was training for my second marathon back in 2010. You worked long hours. I had two little boys at home, so I would take them to childcare at the local YMCA during the week and do my runs on the treadmill. And I was fortunately able to do my long runs outside on the weekends. But yeah, I mean, there is definite times when the treadmill can come in very handy. And we do have a few articles over on the MTA blog about how to incorporate the treadmill into your training and even enjoy it more. And a couple of years ago, we had a conversation with one of our coaches, Coach Chris. He is a sub-3-hour marathoner and accomplished triathlete. And he was talking about how when he lived in Bangladesh, he trained for 4 marathons and a half Ironman exclusively on the treadmill, just because of a variety of conditions there.
Yeah. So imagine that, doing every run on the treadmill, long runs included.
Yeah, that's dedication right there. Also, some runners with arthritis often find the treadmill to be more of a gentle surface for their joints. So, you know, there are some good reasons to incorporate the treadmill into your training. And I typically recommend that at least 50% of your long runs be done on a similar surface to your race surface. So, Craig, if you're doing a road marathon, it's wise to do 50% of your long runs on roads just to better prepare your body for the demands of that surface and to get used to what it feels like to pace yourself outside without the benefit of a constantly moving treadmill belt. Because there are obviously differences between the feel of running on treadmill and running on the roads. And especially if it's your first marathon, you really need to kind of build up the support structures of your body and to be able to handle the pounding that the roads can give your body. So yeah, you know, if you can get in at least 50% of your long runs outside, that would be a huge benefit. And we also have some great tips from Henry Howard. He's a writer for MTA over on our blog, and he has some great suggestions about learning to like the treadmill more, because for many people, it's a real struggle. You know, for some reasons, they maybe have to do a long run on the treadmill, and it just can become this huge area of dread. Mm-hmm. I know I don't look forward to long runs in the treadmill. The longest distance I've had to do was 16 miles, and it felt like I was on there for like days, to be honest.
That's the tough part of it. And you just watch that little number. It hardly ever moves, you know, and you're like, oh, I got so much further to go. I think my treadmill PR is 14.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's more of a mental game. But Henry says a few things. He says, you know, keep in mind the surface of the treadmill is more forgiving than roads. Also, if you don't have access to trails, doing intermittent treadmill runs can help your body recover from the pounding that it can take on the roads. So it can actually, you know, be a good way to lighten up the impact for your body. Another benefit is running on the treadmill can allow you to check your form. You can watch your form in a mirror, or you can record your movements on your phone so that you can go back and check and make sure that your strides, your hip rotation, arm swings are all benefiting you.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
Because often we think we look one way when we run and we actually look different.
Yep.
Plus, it's a good way to catch up on the latest audiobook, listen to a podcast, or catch some favorite tunes. Other people like to do some binge watching of the latest Netflix series, and you can, you know, do that guilt-free when you're pounding away in some miles.
Watch the movie 3100.
Yes, that would be perfect. Like we talked about, if you live in an area where air pollution or allergies is an issue, running indoors can keep all that nasty stuff out of your lungs. And of course, the treadmill may be a safer option in extreme heat and cold conditions too. Another benefit is if you're traveling and unsure of where it's safe to run outside, a hotel treadmill can be a nice reprieve. I've done that before, you know, just not being familiar with an area or just being located by a busy interstate. Just being able to jump on a hotel treadmill can help you keep up your training even when you're traveling. And also, like we alluded to, running on the treadmill can sharpen your mental fortitude. If you can run X number of miles on the treadmill, then you can certainly power through your next race or long run outdoors. So it really helps you build up that mental strength.
Think about having a treadmill PR, which has to do with number of miles you've covered on it. Don't worry about time it took you, just the number of miles, which represents the monotony that you endured for that many miles.
That's right.
See if you can beat our treadmill PR. Mine's 14, Angie's is 16. I'm sure you guys could beat us, so give it a shot.
Yes, and happy training, Craig, as you incorporate the treadmill into your marathon prep.
And Angie, we are going to be doing a lot of outside running, a lot of outside hiking this summer. Do you have any just tips in general for allergy sufferers out there?
Well, you know, get on a regular allergy medication if your allergies are severe. And also, you know, you can check pollen counts. And there's certain times of the day that are often better to run than others and certain conditions. So you can always check ahead and do that. Another tip is to, when you come back from a run, take off all your running clothes and get in the shower right away. Wash your hair. That can help remove pollen from your body. Some people like to use a neti pot to clear out their sinuses. I personally don't enjoy using one. And there's a lot of different things that you can do to help mitigate the effects of pollen and things that aggravate allergies.
When your allergies are fully irritated, do you just feel like scratching your eyeballs out or what?
Yeah, for me, I feel just like I have a huge amount of mucus in my head just building up and, you know, often very explosive, sneezing a lot. A lot of nasal drainage, and when it gets super bad, my eyes just itch and itch and itch, and it gets out of control, so it's no fun.
All right, well, I hope that helps you guys. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener, and if you've been listening for a while, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes if you get a chance. It does help our show get found by more runners. Of course, we'll have links to everything that was mentioned in this episode over on our blog, marathontrainingacademy.com. All kinds of good stuff over there. You can also send us a question or a comment through our contact form on the website. And thanks again to MetPro for sponsoring this episode. They are a fitness and nutrition concierge service that help you dial in your metabolic rate and get you burning fat and feeling great. Check them out at metpro.co/MTA. We're looking forward to a great summer with lots of miles and lots of stories. bringing you guys along with us on our trip out west. We also have some amazing guests planned for the podcast in the coming episodes, so stay tuned for that. It's great to be on this running journey with you. Always remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way.